The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab number 257 for Wednesday, April 28th, 2010.
Welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab here from Durham, New Hampshire. I am Dave Hamilton. On the other end of the Skype line, our good friend
John F. Braun here in Fairfield, Connecticut. And you know, Dave, it seems like we just did this.
We
did. Like days ago.
Yeah, but we didn't answer any questions, so we had to come back and, you know, dig through the mailbag. It had been over a week since we touched the mailbag, so, you know, it was time. I think it was time.
I agree, and that was a fun show.
It was. If you hadn't had a chance to listen to 256 yet, you can. You can also go watch it right now on our Ustream channel, I guess. So, I had a blast. Barrels of fun.
The barrel of monkeys, even.
We didn't provide
the monkeys, but we had people in the chat room, so that was about that. And no, we're not calling our listeners monkeys.
No, not all of them. Just kidding.
Oh. But no, it was fun in the chat room here. Yeah, you know, we probably could have used Pete to moderate, but he's off in the air somewhere.
Yeah, that's right.
It's kind of hard to follow video and chat room and just all the stuff going on. But anyways, it was great. It was so much fun to share our roots with people, and frighteningly enough, a lot of people actually knew what we were talking about and actually chimed in with even more dated technology than you and I had used.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Anyways.
So, you know, it has been over a week, and the reason it's been over a week is, of course, I was away last week. We went, we took the kids down to Washington, D.C., and just had a grand old time. But, you know, as with any travel experience, there's always, you know, a couple of things technologically that creep into the experience of the week. And last week, of course, was no exception.
Yeah. Well, you were old school this time, because Dave, I think you usually, when I come visit you, I mean, I've driven and I've taken the train, but I think you typically like to fly, but you, so this is something new for you, I think. You were kind of retro here in that you did the Amtrak.
Yeah, when traveling locally, and when I say locally, I mean, you know, Eastern Seaboard. I've taken the train. I took the train to Trenton, New Jersey last year when I did the Princeton Mac Users Group chat. And, you know, I'll do the train every now and then, going back and forth to New York. But a lot of times the schedule doesn't work out so well. But this time the schedule worked out great. The four of us took the train. It was less than half the price of flying, and it added a little bit of time to the journey for sure. But not terrible, because you don't have to get to the train station as early as you would for a flight. And the train station is in D.C. right in the middle of town, so you're pretty much right at your hotel when you get there. Or at least we were. So.
You got some amenities. Like, the one thing I love about Amtrak is that you have a 120 volt, because so you have a 120 volt, so you can plug your computer, and hopefully you guys got,
of course, you get that
seats.
You get that on most airlines now. So,
I've still seen some that still require a stupid proprietary adapter.
Right.
Maybe in the class that you fly in, you get a 120 that you don't need a.
That's right. Yeah. Not for WWDC though, which was also announced today. But it was too late to book flights for WWDC that had any. I like to use mileage and, you know, fly up front, but that wasn't the option this time. So, but anyway, so on the train ride down, my daughter brought her Hackintosh, her little Dell laptop. I brought both the iPad and my MacBook Pro. It was my first trip since I got the iPad, and I figured, well, I'd better take the MacBook Pro as well. But I also brought the MiFi, and that turned out to be a fantastic thing, especially on the train, but also all week in the hotel room. We didn't buy internet access from the hotel for, you know, whatever they wanted, $19 a day or whatever it turns out to be. We just used the MiFi, and it was great. Now, here's what I did on the MiFi. On the way down, we loaded up our computers and our iPods and iPads and iPhones with TV shows or movies or whatever to watch, you know, on the way down. And I realized about halfway through the trip, I thought, you know, we've got enough here to make this trip down fine. But the 7.5-hour train ride back, you know, we're going to be out of stuff. So And we were playing some games too. I mean, we were watching TV the whole way, but I knew coming back, we were going to be pretty tired. It was a late in the day thing. It was going to be after a week of, you know, running ourselves ragged around DC. So I thought, you know, we better get some more stuff. So from the train on the, now this was on the laptop, but I guess I could have done it from the iPad, but it was on my MacBook Pro, connected to the MiFi, moving on the train. I VPN'd in, of course, into our home network here, and I've got the simple little PPTP VPN set up through the DDWRT firmware, if there's enough acronyms there. Yep. So I VPN'd in, I woke up the iMac in the house, and I use the iTiVo software to, you can pull stuff off the TiVo, and as you're pulling it off, you can convert it to, you know, whatever format you want it to be in. So knowing that I was going to want to watch some of this stuff on laptop screens and the iPad as well as the iPhone, I had it convert everything to the iTiVo setting for Apple TV, which is, you know, like 900 pixel wide resolution and stereo sound. So that's going to be enough. It'll give us decent quality. And it did. I'll stand up right now on the soapbox and say I am a hypocrite. I wanted to experiment with the new feature that they put in iTiVo that automatically skips commercials. It uses this open source thing called ComSkip. And let me tell you, it works brilliantly. You're watching a show and it enters a commercial and then bam, you're right back to the show. It just completely omits it. I did it for a couple of reasons. One, I wanted to experiment and see if it actually worked. Two, I wanted to keep the files that we were going to have to then download from the house here as small as possible. And then number three, navigating, scrubbing fast forward and reverse on the iPad or the iPhone is terrible. It's not like the TiVo where it's smart about it. And when you get to a spot, it rewinds a little bit to catch up for you. Mm-hmm. It's a terrible thing. So yes, I'm a hypocrite and I use the commercial skip thing. I'll just state that right up front. What I had it do was I queued up all these shows in iTiVo and I said, go ahead and convert. And I told it to save them to a folder on my Dropbox on that machine. And then when we got to the hotel, I plugged in the laptop, connected it to the MiFi, of course, wirelessly, and instantly all the stuff starts streaming down over the airwaves. And we had our shows and, you know, it took several hours to convert and then several hours to download each one. But, you know, so because it worked so well, I wound up doing it throughout the week and just queuing things up, even shows that were on, you know, Monday, Tuesday, Thursday kind of thing. And then we queued it up. I synced them all. I used the laptop to sync them down to the iPad because, of course, there would have been no way to download these directly to the iPad and keep them there, which is a shame, but it worked great and made for a pleasant ride home. I actually downloaded a movie for the kids and mm-hmm. a couple of TV shows for Lisa and I, and you know, it helped.
Now I'll give you a little something just that may help both you and others. Now I believe that you're with Comcast, Dave? Mm-hmm. Okay, well, you may have seen this news, but I'm going to break it to you if you haven't heard about it.
Okay.
They recently did a cross-vendor Wi-Fi deployment here.
Okay.
You may have heard about this. So basically, I saw this announcement. One of my Twitter folks, I can't remember who it was, told me about this, and then I saw the press release. But basically, three of the cable companies, at least in my area, they also offer Wi-Fi.
Mm.
I think as a goodie, like mine, if I have Optimum Online, which I do, they offer Optimum Wi-Fi. And
okay.
You can actually key your device to it, so you don't have to type in username or password. It just goes by the MAC address.
Oh, cool.
They just did a cross-vendor thing where now the hotspots for Time Warner, Optimum Online, and I believe it's Comcast, which has a different name if it comes up in your list, they basically cross-authorize all of them.
Oh.
So wherever one exists, the other two will also offer access.
Okay.
Which basically means is that wherever I am, if I see Optimum Wi-Fi come up, I also see Time Warner Wi-Fi come up, and then it's some silly misspelling.
Okay.
But anyways, so the nice thing is that for people that I think, so Optimum is pretty much the Northeast. Comcast, I think, is pretty much everywhere, and I think Time Warner as well. I'm not sure the geography of them. Again, Optimum is pretty much, I think, the Northeast, like now, Connecticut and New York City.
Now, I believe I'm reading about this as you're telling us about it, John.
Okay.
But I believe the announcement was just earlier this month, and it's only in New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut.
Oh, okay, so it's limited to this area.
Yeah,
but still,
yeah.
So if you're but yeah, so if you're getting close to me, Dave,
right,
then you should be able. I mean, if you're a Comcast subscriber, you should be able to leech onto this. So just thought I'd mention it because it's nice, and I think they're basically positioning themselves. So if you're happy with them, you're not going to go with another vendor of connectivity.
Right. Smart. That's good. That's good. So anyway, so the whole thing worked. The MiFi was the linchpin to it. Because over hotel Wi-Fi, we all know that that there's no way I would have been able to download, you know, gigabytes. And I mean, I probably downloaded, you know, close to, I don't know, 5 or 6 gigs throughout the week. If you ever tried that on most hotel Wi-Fi, you know that it's an exercise in futility. So the MiFi really worked out well, and I was getting good speeds there from it, and iTivo worked, and you know, it was a great little thing, and I didn't sweat it at all. I just every night, you know, before I went to bed, I'd log in and see what shows we wanted. I'd queue them up, and then, like I said, I pointed the download directory straight to the Dropbox, so it was just boom and
nice. Good to go. Now, did you bring along? I'm just going to plug one thing that should appear by the end of this week, but I just completed my detailed or in-depth review, as we call them at Back Observer, of the Wi-Fire. And I don't know if you brought that with you.
No, no reason to, because I was using the MiFi.
Okay.
So, you know, in most hotel rooms, I'm not using their Wi-Fi anymore anyway. I'm just using the MiFi. So the Wi-Fire has kind of become a thing of the past for me. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, it's something, especially with the latest version, which is their third generation, that I like. And so, you know, I basically just completed a review of that. My review is for the most part, very positive.
Cool.
In that if you have a Wi-Fi antenna and you want to get Wi-Fi and you're somewhere, this thing will help.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. Oh, yeah. I agree. I've never had a bad experience with it. It's just not part of my my routine.
Okay.
At least at the moment. But we'll see if I, you know, wind up moving past the MiFi to something else. Then
all right. So what else did you see, Dave?
Well, you know, I want to mention one gadget that I used in the room all week. So we had four of us staying in one hotel room, which worked out fine. We had two laptops, one iPad, three iPhones, a couple of iPods, and my daughter's cell phone, which is a Razor. And so, of course, we had to charge all of these things on a semi-regular basis, maybe not every day, but, you know, certainly regularly. And other than the laptops, I was able to plug everything into one device to charge, and that was the Call Pod. I don't know if you've ever seen this thing, John, but it's like a disc that has a little cord that, you know, you plug into a power outlet. And then all around the disc are little ports, and you buy from CallPod, and you get a bunch of them free with the pod when you get it. But you buy little adapters, so all these ports have a custom socket on them, and so then you get a dock connector to CallPod connector, you know, a USB to CallPod connector, you know, all these different things matching to your specific devices, and you just plug all these things in and then it charges them, no problem. I was able to charge the iPad with it, which as iPad owners know,
really?
requires
that
a 10 volt circuit. Yep. Now it was interesting, I could do an iPad and one iPhone but not an iPad and two iPhones. And presumably that's just because of the amount of juice that they were drawing. You know, the call pod only gets so much from its DC transformer. But it was so cool and saved so much space. I mean, it was one plug into the wall. We put this little spider thing in the middle of the desk, and it just had all the, you know, all the little adapters shooting off of it. And we just plug in when you get back and you just plug in. Boom. Good to go. It was awesome. So awesome. I'm so glad I grabbed it and put it in my travel.
So this is with the adapters, this is the universal charge center.
That's it.
Everybody used.
That's right.
Outstanding.
That's right. Yeah.
Okay. So, and the one other thing you saw. Well, one thing I'm going to comment on the tweets that you were making on your trip, because I follow you, Dave.
Yes.
Whether you like it or not. and I think you pretty much admitted that. Well, that's what Twitter is all about.
Yeah, I know.
But I think you pretty much admitted that at this point in time, and it's good that you brought your MacBook, but it sounds like at this point in time, the iPad does not fully meet your needs for a travel device.
You know, if it weren't
was your statement, but because of one thing.
Okay, so yeah, you're taunting me here to head down this path, and I'm going to head down it. So there were two things this week where I could not use the iPad. For the most part, I did just if anytime I needed to use it, which is light usage on vacation, right? To be fair, there were two things where I needed to use the computer. One was to download all these shows that, funnily enough, I wanted to put onto the iPad, right? So I was unable to do that directly with the iPad, which is stupid. Presumably that'll be fixed someday. The other thing that I don't think will be fixed, but I am now a firm believer that the iPad should support Adobe Flash. And I know this is a religious argument. It'd be easier if I just came on the show here, I think, and said, listen, guys, the Mac sucks. I'm switching to Windows. Okay. I think that might come across a little bit better. But the reality is, you know, when I'm on vacation and the iPad's a perfect vacation machine, if it weren't for these two things, I'd be totally fine. But, you know, you're on vacation. You don't know where you're going to go out to eat at night. Right. This is something we went through every night. And so we get back to the hotel in the afternoon and we, you know, kind of look at the list of what the, you know, the hotel had kind of a list of restaurants, but you could also go to, you know, Urban Spoon or any of these websites, Yelp, and find restaurants, but, you know, family friendly, decent food, yada, yada. It's not easy to find all that stuff, but we'd find, you know, three or four. And then I'd go to visit the restaurant's websites. And as soon as I would go to their website, 9 times out of 10, the website needed Flash. And it wasn't just it needed Flash for some kooky animation or something that I didn't care about. It needed Flash in order for me to see the menu, in order for me to get information, all of this stuff. And the reality is, yes, Flash sucks. Yes, it makes our computers crash. Yes, it eats up CPU time. And yes, it would be a terrible experience on a mobile device. However, more terrible than having Flash enabled on the mobile device is having Flash not enabled on the mobile device, because it was totally useless to me to get any of that information. I had to put the iPad away, open up the laptop and go down that path, you know, and just to look at a restaurant's menu. That's all I want. Right. You know, but for that stuff. And I had people arguing with me on Twitter. Well, the designers shouldn't. Yeah, I know the designers shouldn't do this. But the reality is they've been doing it for years. And yes, maybe they will change. But in the interim, the iPad is a crippled device because of it, as is the iPhone. But I never experienced it the same way with the iPhone because I don't expect the iPhone to replace my laptop when I'm traveling. Whereas with the iPad, it's a bigger screen, more interactive, more immersive. I do expect that. And it doesn't work. And here's the I'm going to let you get a word in edgewise, but I'm going to get mine in first. Here's the reality. I know Apple has come out and said, oh, it's not important. Flash isn't important. HTML5 is the future. Blah, 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 BS. If they truly believe that, they would not ship OS X with the Flash plugin pre-installed. That's all I'm going to say. I'm good. Mm-hmm. Now for your word in edgewise.
Well, the word edgewise, and that I saw, I think one of the more vocal individuals, our friend John Welch.
Yep.
And I would concur with him. I'm an engineer, not a designer. But to me, but as you pointed out, Dave, the problem is too many people have gone down this path and there's no way to pull them back. To me, in my humble opinion, it is poor design to assume capabilities of the client.
But here's the thing. For the last five, at least, probably 10 years, maybe, but certainly the last 5 years, it is safe to assume that someone browsing the web has Flash.
But, you know, I tried this and you may have seen my tweet doing this. And actually, it was you want to talk retro, Dave. I brought up Think Commander, and just for kicks, I decided to compile Lynx. Do you remember Lynx, Dave?
I do. But that's not a reasonable man test. Right. You know, the average person who buys a Windows machine for $500 and sets it up doesn't even know that Lynx exists. So, you know, using that as the benchmark for a website, I reject the presumption.
Well, I reject you rejecting my presumption. No, to me, now, in a perfect world, you would have infinite resources in order to code for infinite possibilities. And one is, oh, look, the person for people that don't know, Lynx is still made. Lynx is a text only browser.
Right.
Now, a lot of sites I went to with it, they totally crashed. Now, I got to say, for the most part, when I went to TMO, the text part came out okay. Of course, I didn't see the Flash ads or whatever graphical ads because there are no graphics. But a lot of sites so I'm with you, Dave. The thing is, you can't accommodate everybody like weenies like me that want to compile links to text-only browser and expect to get any useful information. Amazingly, though, a lot of sites seem to have some people who actually tested against this and said, you know what, we'll throw you this bone, at least. But it was a fun adventure for me because And it's something we'll link to, but it's called Think Commander. It's a very nice package manager that lets you, under OS X, compile these open source things and run them. And actually, I was shocked that it worked. I shouldn't be, but anyways. Yep. And did you have you had one more tidbit?
Yeah, we'll save the tidbit for the end. Let's get into some questions.
Oh, yeah.
Here. Yeah, yeah. We'll save the so there's my that's my vacation thoughts there. Let's jump right in with Jeff and I'll read Jeff's question here, John. Jeff says, how does one keep their bookmarks available online no matter what computer you might be using? It used to be that .Mac or MobileMe kept your Safari bookmarks available, but that's no longer the case. I'm constantly finding myself in a place where I have no cell phone access, but with good wired internet access on someone else's computer, and not being able to remember the site I found and bookmarked just recently. Have you any ideas as to how to seamlessly make my bookmarks available from other computers? Can I put my Safari bookmarks file into my Dropbox folder? And is there a way to automate this? Okay.
Number one.
Yes.
I'm kind of missing. I believe there was mention of MobileMe or .Mac and bookmark syncing.
Yeah.
Last
it's a shame
checked,
that went away.
Well, what do you mean it went away?
Well, you can't. Okay, so you can sync from computer to computer, no problem. But you
Correct.
Used to be able to have access to your bookmarks if you went to Mac.com.
I see what you're saying.
Yes.
Okay, because I look at my MobileMe, you know, system preference, and under sync is bookmarks. Okay, so
Works
that's specific
yep.
to Safari.
Yes, it syncs your Safari bookmarks to your other computers and also to your iPhone and iPad if they're synced to your MobileMe
okay.
account. That still works, just to be clear. Yeah, but it's the whole
okay.
issue of you can't see them if you visit Mac.com or me.com.
Yeah, yeah, and I've noticed that too. Now,
yeah.
what? Oh, Dave, I'm. What other way could there be for you to take your bookmarks and share them among computers?
Well, you know,
and I know the answer, but I'm asking you.
Yeah, well, Jeff gives us at least he opens the door, right? And he says, you know, is there a way to do it with Dropbox? And of course, as we found, there is. But the Safari bookmarks file, if you're using Firefox, you could actually store your bookmarks file right in the Dropbox folder and just link to it, and everything should work fine. However, or actually put a link to your Dropbox folder in your, put a link to your Firefox bookmarks in your Dropbox folder. However, Safari stores its bookmarks, not as an HTML file, but as a plist file. And because of that, you have to export them. Safari will let you export them, right? File, export bookmarks, and you can save them. As far as Apple scripting it, I'm pretty sure that part of Safari is scriptable. It certainly would be with user interface scripting. So you could do it that
okay.
way.
Yeah. And that file, and I looked at that file, Dave. So what it does, yeah, normally exports, and we discussed it, is available. You don't need the developer or debug menu. And it exports it to something where here's another throwback to the past, because I looked at the guts of the file. When you export the bookmarks, it exports it normally to a file called safaribookmarks.html, which is just a regular HTML file. Any browser can open this. It may not be the best way to get to your bookmarks, but it basically opens a page that shows all your bookmarks and it has the headings and the categories and stuff. But one thing I noticed, Dave, was kind of interesting is at the very top of the document, it has a less than sign, exclamation point, doc type, netscape-bookmark-file-1, closing it.
That's a XML description, right? So that an interpreter knows what to do to read that file.
Yeah. Yeah. So programs, and I think this is looking because, of course, Netscape is pretty much, you know, goodbye. So this is basically a standard that I think Netscape came up with and Apple adheres to, and I'm sure others. So if you export to this file, most other browsers, I would assume Firefox and others, if they see this file, will say, oh, I know what this is. This is a bookmark file from somebody, and I'm going to import that and then, you know, offer it in the native format. So, but the good news is that you can export it. You could store that. Again, the access is a little hokey if you double click on this and it brings it up as a web page, but the answer is yes. You can, you know, store this file on Dropbox or MobileMe or whatever and open that with a, you know, kind of a crude interface, but it still is an interface to your bookmarks.
That's right. That's right. So that would be the way to do it. I did not find an Apple script to do that, but my guess is, well, maybe one of you finds it and we'll link to it and mention it in a future show. I do want to talk about our first sponsor here, which is AudioEngineUSA.com. The folks at Audio Engine have been making speakers for a while, and they, before they even started down this path of actually building the speakers, what they did is they thought, what is it that people are going to be listening to? And the answer is, well, for the most part, people are listening to MP3s, files that have been compressed, audio compression, right? And there are some sound differences there. And with that, they designed these speakers to play MP3s to the best quality that's possible. So they looked at kind of the overall EQ pattern of what happens with an MP3, and they tried to compensate for that. And the result is that any of their speakers really have a rich, full sound, especially when plugged into your computer playing music. You've heard us talk about the A2 speakers. Today, I want to talk about their big brother, the A5s. These are the speakers that I've got right here on my desk where we podcast. These are what I would call bookshelf speakers. They are certainly can fit on your desk. They're about 8 inches tall. And maybe almost a foot tall. Yeah, probably about 8 inches tall, maybe 5 inches deep. Two separate enclosures. Each enclosure has two speakers in it, a tweeter and a woofer. They've got a bass port on the back. The left one has an amplifier in it. So you plug that into your computer and into a wall outlet for power. And then you run a cable over to the right speaker. You can split them apart to get a good stereo field. They've also got an audio in jack on the front, on the top, actually, so that you can plug your iPod in, and it's got a USB charging port on the top, so you can charge your iPod right there. The A5 speakers are available in black and white for $349 from AudioEngineUSA.com, and they come in a wood grain enclosure for another $100, $449. Everything from Audio Engine is available with their free audition, which means you can buy these things, check them out. If within 30 days you decide you don't like them, send them back. They'll give you all your money back. In addition, because you're a Mac Geek Gab listener, you have a special coupon you can use. So you can order these speakers and save 10% by using a coupon MGGTEN. That's MGG10 spelled out. And that'll give you 10% off. So $35 off on the black or white, and $45 off on the wood grain, all available at AudioEngineUSA.com.
And I got the A5s, and I got to say that they're the only speakers I dare turn up to 11, Dave. And they will go to 11.
Yeah, they do sound good.
Oh, they did. Well, they don't distort. You know, that's the thing that blew me away with these things. I turn them all the way up. They rock.
That's good.
Okay.
That's good. I'm going to mess with the order here of our agenda, John. I think Kent is a good place to go next. So Kent is considering getting a time capsule. He's going to have another Mac in the house soon. And he says he's got a couple of questions as they relate to the time capsule. So we'll answer them two in a row here. Number one, when I've got a USB connected hard drive to my Mac and I disconnect it without first ejecting it, Mac OS complains. If I'm using the time capsule for my Time Machine backup, does that drive show up on my desktop as a mounted drive? And if so, if I leave my wireless network without first ejecting said drive, i.e. put the machine to sleep and just leave with it, will I constantly have to dismiss these messages? Or does the OS know enough to recognize the difference? All right, that's question number one. So let's answer that, and then we can answer question number two. Yeah. You want to take this one, John, or should I?
Well, I think the answer is that a Time Machine and Time Capsule take care of it, at least my recent experience. But with the caveat that you have to, at least once when you set up Time Machine and Time Capsule, you have to make sure that drive is mounted.
No, with Time Capsule, you don't have to mount the drive the first time. It'll find it. Yeah.
Okay, I'm sorry. I'm thinking back to the do-it-yourself thing I was doing with Airport Extreme and an external drive. In that case, of course, as you're saying, the drive is already part of the time capsule. So from what I've seen, as long as you're adhering to their approved or even, somewhat unapproved, it figures it out. It mounts the drive, it does the backup, and then it gets rid of it when it's done. And I've seen this, and actually a nice tool to see when this is happening, Dave, is our friend Hardware Growler, which I love oh so much, because I see it shows me when these Time Machine or Time Capsule events are occurring, and I just find it comforting to have it tell me ahead of time. Sometimes it's usually not a surprise sometimes, but it'll say, oh, I'm mounting in my case, time capsule. I'm like, oh, okay, that's cool. And so anyways, that's my feedback
and,
on
and
that.
That's right. Okay, so to answer, and you're right, the time machine will mount and dismount the time capsule drive as it should when it's starting and stopping backups. To answer Kent's question more directly, though, time capsule aside, the reason that you're getting that message when you yank a USB drive from your machine is because your Mac is managing that drive, right? Okay. And there might be some additional cache files to be written, or maybe there might be some other stuff going on that has not yet finished on the drive. There might be temp files open. There might be some other things. And when you disconnect it that way, you can cause damage, actually, to the disk, either typically not physical, you know, hardware damage, but the directory can wind up getting screwed up if there's been a directory change or a table of contents change, and that has not yet been written to the drive but is sitting in memory of the computer, i.e. the device managing the drive, then you have a problem because you've taken the manager away from the drive prematurely or unexpectedly. With network devices, your Mac is not managing that drive. Whether it's a time capsule, whether it's a shared drive on another Mac, you know, on a server, it doesn't matter. Your Mac's not managing the drive. So there is no cord to yank. There is no issue there. If you've got the drive, any network drive mounted, you close the drive and you go somewhere else and you open up your machine and now the drive's, not accessible. It doesn't matter. Now, if you had files open on that drive, let's say you had a network share, you'll get a complaint. The OS will, when you try to access, either read from or write to those files, the OS will say, well, wait a minute, I can't. You know, that path doesn't exist anymore. You're going to have to figure this out. And sometimes that can cause you problems, but it's not the same kind of problems that you'd have just yanking a USB drive. So, in short, Kent, nothing to worry about. And you got the geeky answer there, so...
You know what kind of bugs me that's still necessary, but I guess it still is.
Yeah, it is what it is.
I mean, I guess the only advice is that, well, this is pretty much a given, but, you know, a journaled file system will help guard against, I think, most nastiness.
That's right. That's right.
But then that's pretty much the default. If you're formatting a drive on your Mac, and journal to me implies that there's a history of, you know, what has happened to the drive. And yeah, if terrible things happen and you do, you know, either shut the machine off when you shouldn't or don't, you know, properly eject a drive, you know, that's one area on all platforms, David, I think needs some fixing.
Yeah, it's true. And journaling, you're right. It addresses that in a way that still fits in with the manner in which we attach these drives. That's right. All right. So Kent's second question, he says, I currently use a portable USB drive as my time machine drive. If I get the time capsule and set it up as the primary backup, can I still use the USB drive for time machine when I travel? In other words, can you have two time machine backup locations and have the OS recognize which one is currently attached? And the answer here, Kent, is kind of sort of yes. You can have two backup destinations. However, you'll have to manually change between them when you travel and when you come home. You'll have to go into System Preferences, Time Machine, and set the backup destination. But once you do that, it will resume where it left off, because when a Time Machine backup starts, it looks at the destination for guidance as to what to back up next. So you're totally fine switching between multiple backup destinations. There's just no way within the OS to automatically do it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Good. Where are we on time here? Just trying to pace this. Yikes.
I'm with you. I'm wrestling with Time Machine actually as of late. I actually did one thing. I don't know if you've ever delved into this, Dave. I believe it's MDUtil is the utility that handles a lot of the Time Machine stuff. There's a compress I believe it's compress. There was a compress operation. Maybe we should... I'll hold off on that.
Okay.
I'm experimenting with ways because I had an unusually large backup when I switched to my new hard drive. I'm trying to figure out how to get rid of it. It's not as easy as I thought. No. But there is a way to take a sparse image and compress it.
Now, you actually want to use data compression on it? Or are you talking about clearing out unused space on it?
No, what I'm talking about is that, so typically a sparse image, which if you're doing a wireless backup, a sparse image typically does not shrink. It only grows.
Right, right. I know what you're talking about now. Okay.
Okay. Yeah. Now, there is a way with MDUtil, yes, which is the utility, and I tried this, and I actually recovered and apparently did not destroy anything, but I was starting to get annoyed because there's this 150 gigabyte block of data that doesn't need to be there, but it is. Okay. And I wanted to try to figure out how to get rid of it. And it's not as easy as just deleting that specific backup using something like Time Tracker or something like that. But there is a way. MDUtil offers a way. And again, I believe it's a compress where you can point to a sparse image or a sparse bundle and say, you know what? If there's anything inside of you that's wasteful, ditch it. And I actually ran this and I recovered, I think, about 10 gigabytes.
Huh.
And then it went through and went through the bands or whatever it does. And it basically said, you know what? I don't need this. So it wasn't the reduction I expected, which was 150 gigs. I'm still trying to figure out how to get that back. And actually, Katie ran into this as well.
I'm gonna clear up some of your terminology. MDUtil is the spotlight utility.
I'm sorry.
So you're talking about HDI util, which is the disk image utility, hard drive image utility.
You're correct.
And I think you're talking about compact, not compress, right? Is that the command
here
you're
we
talking
go.
About?
Right. Okay. No, I'm looking right now.
All right.
HDI util.
Yep.
Compact. And then okay. You point to a file.
Yep.
And if it can, and, you know, it sits there and, you know, it chugs for a while, but it actually said at the end of it, it's like, oh, okay, 10 gigs.
Cool.
You got it back, which it reduced it. And I see this in the Time Machine.
Yeah, it does it before a backup usually, or maybe sometimes after. But yeah, you're right. You see it in the logs. Yeah, yeah.
Man. So I'm still pursuing that.
All right, cool.
Moving on.
Let us know what you find. Yeah, that's good. That's good. All right. A bit of correction on something we talked about recently. I talked about and this will be posted as one of our new MGG Answers articles. I didn't have time to get it up before we recorded the show here today, but it will be up in the next couple of days. We talked about viewing. If you want to stream your movies or music from your Mac to your iPad or iPhone, you can do that using the web server built in to your Mac. The trick is you need to tell your Mac to look at those files and make a way for the web server to see those. And typically when you start up the web server, it puts your home directory /sites is the place where you have all that stuff linked. So it would be, you know, whatever your machine's IP address is / your short username / and then whatever you want. And off it goes. And it usually works just fine. And what we talked about doing was putting an alias from your iTunes music folder into your sites folder. That doesn't work. And the reason it doesn't work is because Apache, which is the web engine under the hood, doesn't know how to follow aliases. What it does know how to follow are symbolic links. Unfortunately, creating symbolic links, they're very similar to aliases. In fact, many
What's
of
the difference, Dave?
The alias is a pointer that only OS X sees, whereas a symbolic link is something that OS X and the Unix underpinnings will see. Okay, so the alias is sort of a bogus pointer, if you will. It's not a real pointer. It is for most things, but if you really want things to point, you've got to use a symbolic link. I thought they were the same. Clearly, I was wrong. So you have to go and create a symbolic link, which there's an Apple script that you can use to do it, and we'll point to the link for that. And then there's also a command line, and it's a very, very straightforward command line. It's one line, but you've got to type a lot in. It's LN is the command to make a link, and then a space, and then -S to make it symbolic, as opposed to a hard link, and you don't want to create a hard link here. So LN space -S, and then space. And then you put the full path to the original folder, and then a space, and then in the full path to the link you want. So what I recommend doing is get to your sites folder, and then do LN space -S space, and then you know, type the path to your iTunes library, which is usually, you know, home/music/iTunes/iTunes music/whatever you want. And you can just leave it there and navigate in the web. And then a space, and then, you know, maybe put music. If you wanted to make one to your movies folder, you could do the same thing and name it movies. And then that way, when you visit it in your web browser, on your Mac or on, of course, your iPad or iPhone, you'll get to see this. So, but it has to be a symbolic link. And we'll put an MGG Answers article up. You'll see those whenever we do an MGG Answers article, by the way. It's usually stuff that's come from the show. And if it was discussed in a specific show, we'll link to the show from that article. And then automatically the show links to the article as well. So when you go to the show notes for this show, that MGG Answers article will be cross-linked there. So you should be able to find it. Yeah. Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. All right. Let's talk about our second sponsor for this show, John. And that is GoToAssist. You've heard us talk about this quite a bit. It's a pretty cool product. What GoToAssist allows you to do is gain remote control over someone else's computer, of course, with their permission. And the way that it works is you go to your web browser, log into your GoToAssist account, and create a new session. And you'll get a link. And this link is unique to that session. You then give that link, either email, IM, or you can even read over the phone. You send this link to the person whose computer you want to control. They visit that link in their web browser. There's no account to set up for them. There's nothing for them to do other than visit this link and say, yes, I want to let Dave control my computer. Once they do that, you'll sit there, you'll wait for them to do it. And then suddenly, right there in your web browser, it actually opens a little applet and boom. You're able to see their computer. You can use the mouse. You can use the keyboard. They can see what you're doing. You can see what they're doing. It's fully interactive. And the person on the other end has the ability to stop the connection at any point in time if for whatever reason they're uncomfortable with things moving forward. So John and I tried it. It worked flawlessly. We're both behind routers and firewalls and all that stuff. And because this is a user initiated session on both sides, there was no issue with traversing the firewall or port forwarding or any of that mess. And it just worked. It was seamless. We tried it and it just worked the first time. It's called GoToAssist Express. It's from Citrix. And you can get a 1 month free trial because you're a Geekgab listener by going to GoToAssist.com/gab. That's GAB. So GoToAssist.com/gab for your month long free trial of GoToAssist Express. Go ahead and check it out.
Love it. You know, Dave, can we do Rick?
Yeah, sure.
Rick is just, oh man, it's just a multifaceted question here. No, really, I'm serious. I think it's a great question.
It's interesting. Okay. Rick writes, I recently replaced my original MacBook Air with a new MacBook Pro 13 inch. I'd like to lend the Air to my girlfriend for her to use while at home to browse the web, read email, etc. I've set up a managed account for her with some parental controls limiting her to the apps she will need. I did not delete my own user account. The Air is running the latest version of Snow Leopard, and each user account is password protected. My assumption that was by setting up a separate user account for her use, she would not be able to access any of my files in my user account. As it turns out, I was wrong. Files in my home folder seem to be accessible to her. When she signed into her own user account and does a spotlight search for a document that I know is in my user account home folder, that file appears and is accessible via Quick Look. Does Spotlight search system-wide regardless of user account? Short of disabling Spotlight altogether or removing my home folder, is there a way to prevent her from inadvertently accessing any of my files while doing her own Spotlight searches? All right, so John, you take it. We worked together on this one, but you and I both
dug into this, so we're going to dig into this. So
there is a moral to this, and we're going to get you. We'll get you to the moral. The moral is about a one sentence moral that's important, but we'll get you there the long way. Trust us. This is how we roll.
So, to me, the answer to this question. So, one, if he's asking, should this have happened? The answer is yes. And here is why this should have happened. So I did a bit of digging here, and I normally only have a admin account set up on my machines, but I decided, let me set up what's known as a standard account or even a managed account. And I set up a standard account. And here's the gotcha with a standard account. Even if you're an admin, a standard, I'm going to continue here. So I was on a machine. I had my account and I created a standard account. When I logged into the standard account, I'm like, you know what? Let me go to the users directory on my hard drive. And then let me go to the directory of the admin, which is John Braun. I'm like, oh my gosh, I can get into that directory. Now, number one, to me, that is something that I think is somewhat unexpected, Dave.
I agree.
As a standard user, I can get into parts of, and now here's the key word, parts of the user directory of the administrator. Now, to me, if you're talking security guy, to me, that is bad. That's really bad. Yeah. In that, why are they even allowing this? Here's the good news, though. And here was the advice that I provided to Rick, was that here's what I noticed when I looked deeper, is that although the home directory of the administrator is, and if you dig into the Unix permissions, you know, you right click on the admin directory and you look, and in permissions, the thing is, everyone, and I think it's the group everyone, has read-only access. But here's the key, and here's the hint that I gave to him, and I think he agreed that this is the way to go about it, is that there are select directories within my administrator, not that it matters, but in my home folder, that are marked everybody no access. And here are the directories: desktop, documents, downloads, library, movies, music, and pictures. Now, the thing is, initially when I tried this,
and in fact, of all the default directories that are created in any user account, be they an admin right. or not, the only two that are not restricted from being read are public and Good. Sites.
Good, which kind of makes sense.
Yeah.
So to me, the thing is, I never ran across this issue because, I created a standard account. I logged into it. I then searched for documents that I knew were in my home folder somewhere. And this is the key, Dave. Like I went searching for my tax return, which, you know, I do in PDF and has my financial details. And I would agree is probably something, you know, I don't want to share with the world. And I couldn't find it. I'm like, well, that's weird. Why couldn't I find that? And he's running into the situation where his girlfriend, and again, we'll get to the second question, which I find more entertaining and interesting. But then I'm like, well, that's kind of weird. I'm like, well, let me try this. And I took one of the documents from my documents folder. Here's the key, folks. I put my tax return and all the documents in my documents folder.
Wait.
I copied that folder out of my documents folder into my home directory.
Right.
Then I logged into the standard account. And apparently, in the meantime, Spotlight said, hey, oh, look, new stuff. Let me index that. And when I went to my standard account and said, look for 1040A, it was like, here you go. You can open it. You can look at it. And it's like, well, that's because it's in a directory that's marked as everybody read only. So from what I can tell, Spotlight will honor, to a certain extent, well, it honors the security settings on the directory.
That's right.
If the directory is read only everybody, which your home directory is, now this is another maybe tangent, Dave, why is my home directory read only to everybody?
Presumably because you want your public folder to be read only, to be readable by everyone. And in order for them to get to your public folder, they have to be able to navigate through your user folder.
Okay, but you see where I'm going here is that it seems that the settings here, and I would agree, I think with Rick, is that this was unexpected behavior on the part of the OS in marking the home folder. Now, again, you know, to finger wag at Rick, he was not being very diligent or not as anal as me as far as storing stuff. For me, anything that's a document, I store in my documents folder, which is fortunately one of the folders that is marked as no access by the group everybody.
Right. Yeah. Now, he, in his follow up, in his reply, Rick said, yeah, this makes sense now because I've created other folders in my home folder to further, not within his documents folder, but right at the root level, he's created a couple other folders and he categorizes things that way. And it was items, sure enough, in those new folders that he created. So that the lesson here is if you're going to create new folders at the root level of your home, you know, in your home directory, you need to You need to be aware that by default, they're not protected. Now, as John pointed out, you can easily protect them by going to your folder, do a finder, you know, file get info once you've highlighted the folder. And then at the bottom of that get info window is a sharing and permissions section. If it's not twisted open, you can twist it open. And there you should see where it says everyone read only. What you want to do is you want to change everyone to no access. And then you want to, using the little widget at the very bottom of the screen, click apply to enclosed items. And this way, all those permissions changes will filter and through everything that's in there. And then Spotlight's golden. Then you're fine.
Well, yeah. Dave, I'm going to finger wag you in public here. Okay. In front of her.
Good.
I'm going to say, just put it in your documents folder.
Well, but here's the thing. Sometimes that's not,
that's not going to
happen because the folders that's created, you know, we talk a lot about it here on the show, is a piece of software called Dropbox. And Dropbox creates a folder in your home directory. Now, you can redefine where that is, but I don't recommend doing that. I recommend if you're going to store stuff in the Dropbox folder, it's easier to manage just by having it there. So Dropbox, because it's a new folder created there, has these everyone read, you know, read only permissions. And you may want to change that. And you can. It's very easy. You just go in and you highlight the folders I just explained. So there may be reasons where you want to have additional folders out here, and that's how you protect them. But you're right. If you store everything in your documents folder and you haven't changed your default permissions, then you're totally fine.
Or downloads, or because I understand why they protect those. Now the thing that occurs to me, I guess I'm just I'm now the one solution is, well, I'll just take my home folder and make the whole thing everybody no access.
That might work.
I'm hesitant, and maybe you are too, Dave,
but I am
hesitant to change the default settings of the Mac OS. I got to imagine, and maybe there's a bad reason, maybe there's a good reason, but and actually maybe this is a mini Turbo Geek challenge. I'm going to call it that now. Why does Apple, when they create these new accounts, especially, one, an admin account, but number two, what we call a user account or a personal account, why does it set the permissions to allow everyone read-only? To me, that seems, you know, especially with the ability of Unix to fine-grain the access to you know, individual group and everybody, why are they even allowing this? And I think Rick, he came across a situation where, you know, you got to question the logic behind, why are you even letting people in my user folder? To me, it seems kind of it doesn't make sense.
Right.
I don't know why, but that's how it's set up. And my choice is not to affect that, but to go with the guidelines that Apple has set up. So quick solution, put it in one of those folders. Spotlight will not see it. But then, Dave, I think we had a secondary. I don't know if you want to.
we'll leave the home management, the social management of the home for perhaps another podcast. We've got plenty of stuff to go through here, so we'll leave it at that. We are getting long in the tooth at this one here.
But we
have two possible geek challenge participants here. Now, I think, during our pre-show, I think we might have solved a couple of these, but let's talk about these because there's some cool stuff here. So starting with Melvin, he has two questions. He says, I'm using a 24-inch iMac running Snow Leopard, and occasionally I like to use the dual screen feature to play movies on my TV screen. I run a VGA cable from my computer to the TV. Unfortunately, the only way I know how to disable and enable the dual screen mode is to plug in and out the DVI cable. I was wondering if there's a software fix for this. I'd searched around and there doesn't seem to be a good workaround. One suggestion was to have it mirror the screen instead and switch off the second screen. But does this still tax the GPU with two monitors? All right, so I'm going to answer his question quick, and then, John, I think you've got the real answer.
I think so.
Mirroring would work, and I don't believe mirroring is going to cause any real grief with your GPU. So So, yes, I think that would be one answer. And then that way you're not losing your mouse and having it float off to a screen that you can't see. So mirroring is answer number one, but it does force you to have the same resolution on both. So if your built-in monitor is, you know, 1280 by 960 and the TV is 1024 by 768, well, you're not going to be happy when your internal screen changes to 1024 by 768. So so you may want John's solution.
And here's what I found, and you know, I think I've used this, Dave, in the past where I remember in the past there were situations where the control panel or system preference or whatever in Mac OS X or System 9 or whatever would not reflect all of the capabilities of the monitor. And this is something that I've used over the years. I haven't used it recently, but I think once you and I, Dave, looked at this, I think this will solve the problem. It's something called Switch Res 10, oddly enough, version 4. And it's at www.madrau.com. We will link to it, of course. But I think once I presented this as an option, Dave, you actually dug into and found that they actually do have a feature that apparently gives you fine control over exactly what the heck your screens are doing, including mirroring or selection or things like that. So the thing is, from what I've seen, you can get it, you can download it, you can try it at Shareware. If you like it, you know, throw them a few bucks. Yep. So Switch Res 10 version 4, complete control over your monitor. And I would say I agree with that. They also, now you got to be careful because they do let you get into a geeky area of, you know, talking to your monitor, which I don't think it's as bad as the old days, Dave, where you could actually blow up your monitor.
No, I think they've got circuits in them that just basically turn them black.
They basically say, I can't sync with that frequency. Right. What are you, nuts? Right. But it's a very nice utility that I think will give you as much control over a monitor as you can under OS X. So,
yeah, I think that's right. All right. Now, he had a second part to his question here, where Melvin says, along the same direction, is there a way to switch from headphones to internal speaker without having to plug to take the headphones out? I think I remember you guys talking about this a few months or weeks back. The consensus was that the switching when a plug was put in was a software switch. However, there doesn't seem to be a viable software solution out there. Also, once the headphones are plugged in, you cannot choose internal speakers in the preferences. I've tried Sound Source, but that didn't work either. And Melvin, you're right. It is a software switch, and there did used to be a way you could go in. Both headphones and internal speakers would be listed simultaneously in the sound system preference pane, and it would auto select based on whether or not you had headphones plugged in like it does now. But that didn't stop you from also using the other output. And that was really handy. I liked it because I could leave things plugged in, but I could also have, you know, I could have alert sounds come out through my MacBook speakers, but I could have music coming out through, you know, the speakers plugged into the headphone jack. So no, there is no way, despite the fact that it's a software switch, it appears the OS only shows you one at a time. So that's... it's unfortunate, but we'll throw it out there as a geek challenge. If somebody's figured out or found a way to use both, that'd be awesome. All right.
One more.
Finally. Yeah, we'll do Grant here. This is interesting. Hi, Dave and John. I have my two boys, 4 and 2, play on my Mac every so often. They watch movies and play on certain websites. I do not have a separate account set up for them quite yet. My problem is sometimes they start clicking and they change the names of my disks that are attached. Do you know of any programs or settings that I can set so this won't happen? Will a separate user account do this? Even the wife will sometimes click and start renaming a disk. I've taught her how to rename it back. Any type of help would be appreciated, and I am running macOS 10.5, which he says the latest, so I'm not sure if that's a typo or if he's running 10.5 or if he's running 10.6, but the answer is the same regardless. And that answer is a separate user account. So, yes, it's...
I was going to say, Dave, the answer is who wears the pants?
Well, we already know that by his question here, right?
Well, no, but I'm saying it's... But no, after you and I chatted, because actually when you and I chatted, the thing is, I recall, I believe it was in... our pal OS 9, I believe they had a lock option that would actually lock a drive and make it so you couldn't inadvertently change the name of it.
That's right.
is gone because I could not find that in OS 10. So yes, if somebody errantly, you know, selects a disk and starts typing, yeah, they could rename it. So, but I'm still hinting that it's, you know, part family management.
That's right. Yeah. Well, with a kid, with kids who are 4 and 2 though, that's, you know, that's just not going to work. So,
well, they should get their own computer or at least, and as you're suggesting, their own account because.
Right. Yeah. And Grant, yes, a separate account, as long as it's not an administrator account, cannot change the name of the disk. If you try to change the user account when logged in as a non-admin or standard user, it will ask you for the for an administrator username and password in order to enact that change. And obviously, mm-hmm. unless your kids either get very lucky with their random keystrokes or know your username and password, then no, they won't be able to change that. So yeah, that's your magic answer there, Grant. All right. We've gone through all these questions and shared some tips here. But the one thing we haven't yet done, John, is told all of you how to contact the two of us. And the way you do that is, first and foremost, you can pick up the phone and call 206-666-GEEK, which, John, is...
You know, I've four, three, five. But Dave, you can not only call us and when you call us, you can, you know, you can call us with, well, pretty much a voice question. You can. But you can also, Dave, you can email us. And where would you email us, Dave? Well, I'm going to tell you, Dave, you can email us at MacFeedback@MacGeekGab.com.
Is that feedback@MacGeekGab.com, John?
Well, no.
Can either one of us say it without stumbling over it somewhere?
We've been going a long time here. But anyways, it's feedback@MacGeekGab.com.
There it is.
And that you can send emails. You can send emails with audio attachments.
And if you're a premium subscriber, send to premium@MacGeekGab.com, and that way we know which show we can put it in.
And of course, there's also Skype, though we not prefer that because the audio quality is lacking typically. But hey, you can Skype to MacGeekGab.
It's a shame too because when you do Skype to Skype, the audio quality is great, and Skype's voicemail audio quality is great. But what we do is we link that Skype voicemail to our 206-666-GEEK number so that we can get it in our email box because Skype voicemail will not auto appear in our email box. So we never know when you've sent it to us. So, so that's why the quality is that way. So,
where's the band?
The band's coming in a minute.
I was waiting for the band.
I wanted to get through the contact info and then, you know, I got the little fader here. Bring the band right in.
I always expect the band.
Michael Johnston from the This Week in iPhone podcast converts this to AAC for your interactive pleasure. Cashfly, CACHEFLY.com provides all the bandwidth, and we really appreciate that. The podcast marketplace includes the A5 bookshelf speakers from Audio Engine, Yojimbo, and the new BB Edit 8.5 from Barebone Software. PDF Pen, Text Expander Touch, and more from Smile on My Mac, Notebook from Circus Ponies, and GoToAssist Express from Citrix. Free trial at GoToAssist.com/Gab, all through the Backbeat Media Podcast Network. That's it. We're out of here. Thanks so much for listening. Thanks so much for staying subscribed. And thanks so much for submitting all your questions. It's what makes this show what it is.
More. Give me more.
It's getting to be a lot, man. It was a multi-hour affair today. It was good, though. It's always a good tour. I like it.
It makes me realize, Dave, we're not the only ones that have problems.
That's right. We will be back for you premium folks. We will be back with one more show this week, making it a 3-podcast week. For the rest of you, we'll be back on Monday. Until then,
don't get caught.
Made on that.